at Arizona State University in Tempe, just outside Phoenix, 31-year-old Dr. Michael Millen taught in the Department of Geology. He had a degree in physics from Berkeley and a PhD from Caltech in planetary sciences and geology, and had written his doctoral thesis, much of which involved the science of image processing, on the analysis of spacecraft images of Mars. He then had worked at Jet Propulsion Laboratory for 4 years before joining the ASU staff in 1979, where he now taught geology of the Moon, geology of Mars, and geomorphology. A few weeks after Dilatoso spoke with Eric Eliasson, he discovered Millen and the Image Processing Laboratory at ASU. With joint funding from NASA and the university, Millen and a colleague had acquired for the lab the equipment for analyzing spacecraft images. Local papers often carried articles about the analyses the two scientists performed on photographs beamed back from space, and Dilatoso happened to see one of the articles and called Millen. At their first meeting in mid-May 1981, Dilatoso lay before Millen the array of photographs in the photo journal, plus digitized images of two of the MIR photographs. As Millen's business was the analysis of pictures, he found the photographs interesting, very pretty, very clear, very nicely processed. And he liked to study photographs, so Dilatoso did not have to try to persuade him to look at them. "These pictures are much nicer pictures of UFOs than any I'd ever seen before," Millen said later, "in terms of the number and the quality for that number. You can see they look like real objects. Not just on the impression level, but on a demonstrable level. They glint in the sun, there are distinguishable reflections in the metallic objects, things like that that make them much better pictures. I don't think there's any question that, at least in the things that I've ever seen, these are by far the best UFO pictures taken. Whether they're authentic or not, that's a totally different matter." Millen tried to keep an open mind, willing to consider topics often avoided by his colleagues, but he demanded facts and rendered his opinions with cold objectivity. The senior science editor at National Geographic once remarked, "If Millen says it, you can believe it." Like Eliasson and others before him, Millen wanted far more information than Dilatoso could provide. He told Dilatoso he wanted to see the stuff that actually went through the camera. He wanted the camera itself, to study the lens and metering system. Because of the apparent clarity within the image, he was not bothered by the focus on the camera being jammed just short of infinity. "Absolutely not," he said. "It shouldn't have an effect on whether you're hoaxing it or not." But he wanted to know the shutter speed, the aperture setting, and where the lens was focused. "The important thing would have been the original film," he said. "Without the very detailed information about the originals, there's almost nothing you can say." One more thing he pointed out: photographs are pretty, fun, and impressive. But photographs of anything are poor evidence. In a hierarchy of probative value, photographs and sound lie at the bottom, because they both are a recording of an ephemeral event, subject to manipulation after the fact. "The only real physical evidence," said Millen, "would be some physical manifestation that could be tested and measured and physically examined. If you had a piece of metal whose manufacture could not be done on Earth, that would go a long way." As Millen considered the photographs, he also sized up Dilatoso. His first impression was that the young technician was a smooth and fast talker. "My guess is that he was using my name to JPL and their name to me in an attempt to get something done, but I don't fault him for that. I think he's a pretty bright guy. I think he was perhaps more in favor of this thing being real than he was in favor of debunking it. But he was quite bright, and obviously had worked around computers. For the most part, he knew what he wanted to say, and I don't think he misrepresented anything." Dilatoso met with Millen several times, in the professor's office, in front of computer screens in the image processing facility, and once at his own studio in Phoenix, where Millen had driven to see the image processing system Dilatoso had assembled for himself during the course of his research on the MIR case. Millen was impressed with the system. Dilatoso's computer setup, An estimated $50,000 worth of equipment was as sophisticated as what Malin regularly worked with at ASUS Image Processing Center. "I'm not sure that he could do with it what I could do with it," said Malin, "but he could do things with it." And Malin felt that he himself could do some real science on the equipment. Back in his own lab, Malin entered the digitized images Dilatoso had given him into the computer and began studying them with Dilatoso, and sometimes Stevens, present. "I zoomed up a given section and then just looked for edges," he said. "I looked for contrast differences between various parts of the sky. I looked at the color of the sky reflected in the object versus the sky immediately around it. People say the sky is blue, but it isn't uniformly blue. So I did things like that. And what I found was that the quality of the data he gave me was insufficient to do a detailed analysis, a numerical analysis, of what these things were. But to the level of the quality of the data he gave me, I could not see anything obviously wrong with the images. Couldn't see any hoax to it. There was a proper amount of blurring of edges and distance fading and things like that. To the level that I saw it, I can say that the thing was not a photographic fake. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't a photographic fake. If I had the details of everything I wanted, I might still say there is no obvious thing in it that is fake. But that's photographically fake. It could still be an object 20 feet across held up by a helicopter above it on four strings. I wouldn't know what would motivate someone to fake them, so I don't know how much trouble it's worth, what they expect to get in return. But my opinion would be that it would probably take more than a little camera and more than sending it to the local drugstore. It requires a lot of time. A person's got to want to do this. If they are hoaxes, then I am intrigued by the quality of the hoax. How did he do it? I'm always interested in seeing a master at work. On the other hand, if they're real, then I also have an academic interest in that. My own research is involved in exploration of other planets. And if there were other organisms visiting our planet, they must be doing that for the same reason we explore other planets. Why do we explore other planets? We have a need to expand the sphere of human perception and thought and so on. Maybe that's what aliens do as well. So either way, I win. If they're a hoax, I win by learning a neat technique. If they're not a hoax, I win by having potential colleagues from another planet. I find the photographs themselves credible, he concluded. They're good photographs. They appear to represent real phenomena. The story that some farmer in Switzerland is on a first-name basis with dozens of aliens who come and visit him. I find that incredible. But I find the photographs more credible. They're reasonable evidence of something. What that something is, I don't know. See, though, Dr. Nathan at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory had refused to analyze the mere photos because they provided him with too little information, he consented one morning to view several of the mere films recorded on a half-inch video cassette. The first sequence was black and white, a beam ship moving from side to side above a tall evergreen. At one point, the ship appeared to cut in front of the tree, and the upper branches at the same instant blew as if caught in a sudden stiff wind or a backwash. Nathan laughed. "That's pathetic. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, for God's sake. Look at that thing oscillating. Did you see that? That's the response you'd expect of an extremely light, small object that doesn't have any serious amount of mass associated with it." To Nathan, the object seemed to be oscillating on a very short tether from a point just above its dome. But it would take a tremendous amount of analysis to determine that. "My concern," said Nathan, "is that if we show him at any time involved with a hoax, then it's all a hoax. All you have to do is catch him in one lie and the whole thing goes to hell." Two sequences later, a beam ship seemed to disappear from a point 50 feet above a hillside and reappear only a few feet above the ground, almost in the same frame. As far as Nathan was concerned, it could be a model tethered on a long pole held by an assistant standing behind the photographer. The sights, however, had been described as wide open, with no place to hang models or to stand in such a position to extend a long enough pole into the scene. Nathan said it could be a helicopter. Then three ships hovering behind tree limbs appeared in the sky. "Oh boy," laughed Nathan, Look at that. He surmised they were small objects perhaps 10 feet beyond the branches, and possibly suspended from a long pole with something like a puppeteer's wrench. With his arms folded across his chest, he stood and watched a few more sequences on the television monitor until he saw one where the ship flies in front of snow-capped mountains at Hasenball and comes to an abrupt halt. It then hovers motionless. The concern here, said Nathan, is how he could very steadily move the object from one side of the scene to the other and have it come to an abrupt halt without it appearing to swing. If it were hanging from a long string, and you went ahead and moved the pole and then brought it to a halt, the whole object would tend to move back and forth. But it doesn't. An assistant asked, do you think it could be tethered from some place? I have no idea, said Nathan. He would still have to be awfully clever, because that's a very steady holding. It would have to be a very, very good tethering. I could imagine him filling a weather balloon with helium, speculated the assistant, and then dropping a piece of monofilament, tying it to the object, and then dropping another piece of monofilament from the object and holding that from the ground. It would have to be a set of balloons, said Nathan, because he's able to make the thing go back and forth and it doesn't blow like this off the boom. So it's got to be held rigid somehow, from a point right above the object. Apparently he's a sharp guy, very clever. So he should be given some points for effort. Another intriguing aspect of the Hasenball sequence appeared subtly in the lower right corner of the film, the branch of a pine tree blown continuously by a stiff wind as the ship hovers motionless over the valley. If this is a hoax, Nathan remarked, and it looks like it is to me but I have no proof, this is very carefully done. Tremendous amount of effort. An awful lot of work for one guy. Nathan suggested that maybe Mia was utilizing something like a clothesline with two poles set about 20 feet apart and a model operated by pulleys. The camera can be alone, he noted, and he can be the one all by himself moving the string. But how did Mia transport all that equipment to the site and get those poles in the ground so they provided steady support by himself without being seen? That's his problem, said Nathan. I'm sure he's clever. He's sharp. He's a sharp guy. We're still challenging whether or not this is a hoax. And whether or not that kind of thing is involved is no longer a scientific question. Now you have to bring in people with a detective mentality. My training has always been not to make models which are features in themselves, but rather something that melts into the woodwork so people don't notice. Wally Gentleman had been involved with special effects for over 35 years. As a teenager in England, he had begun his film career developing techniques for shooting down planes by using photographic images on a dome. He studied animation and eventually joined the special effects team at the famous Pinewood Studios in Buckinghamshire, working with rear projection and using photographic means to create backgrounds and avoid expensive sets. From England, he emigrated to Canada in 1957 to serve on the National Film Board for 10 years as director of special effects. While in Canada in 1961, Gentleman made a short film of mostly visual effects titled Universe, which was later discovered by Stanley Kubrick, who contacted Gentleman. He wanted to utilize the techniques Gentleman had created for Universe in his new film 2001. For the next year and a half, Gentleman had served as director of special photographic effects for the Kubrick film. In 1977 he moved to Hollywood and, among other projects, served as an expert visually recreating actual flying saucer reports on the new Jack Webb series Project UFO. You can build a model to fit a certain background, even though it's a scale size, Gentleman said. These are called foreground hanging miniatures in the trade. And if you do it very skillfully, no one can tell the difference. But the skill that you need for that is really quite specific, because when you reduce the size of a model you are still building with full-size textured pieces of wood, plastic, whatever. The trick is to render a model with the right microscopic textures that will fit the true scale of the situation. And then you have to worry about things like the scale of movements, the movement of the background, the simultaneous activity that's going on. Models that are done badly show up like a sore thumb. In early 1980, Bill Jenkins, who hosted a popular Saturday night talk show on Cab Radio, Los Angeles, called "Gentlemen, I have some interesting stuff to show you," he said. "Can you tell me if it's authentic?" At the time, Gentleman worked for Film Effects of Hollywood. When Jenkins brought by the photojournal, UFO contact from the Pleiades, Gentleman perused the photos and told Jenkins, "I'd like very much to see more of this." With Jenkins's help, Gentleman located the elders in Phoenix and a few weeks later flew over to meet them and to view their videotape of Mia's movie footage. After watching each of the 8 segments several times, he said to the elders, "They have a ring of authenticity. But I'd like to examine them to be really sure." In addition to examining the films, Gentleman subjected several of the Mia photos to perspective interlock, a drawing board geometric analysis which he had applied in the independent frame process at Pinewood Studios. If Mia maintained that the beam ships he had photographed measured approximately 21 feet in diameter, Gentleman could take the size of a known object in the scene, a measured tree trunk for instance, and locate where in the scene a beam ship of that size would have to be. The photograph could appear to be authentic, but perspective interlock would expose subtle inconsistencies. Placing the photos on his drawing board and then tracing perspective lines, Gentleman calculated that the beam ships were exactly as Mia had said they were, in size and location. "My big problem area with the Mia pictures," said Gentleman, "is that I have never seen an original negative. And without that I could never really be sure that it had not been doctored in any way at all. But given my particular background, I know it would take an expert of many years of experience even to doctor a picture to make it look authentic." Holding one of the Mia photos in his hand, Gentleman said, "My greatest problem is that for anybody faking this," he points to the photograph, "the shadow that is thrown onto the tree is correct. There are many things that are correct on many of the shots. Therefore, if somebody is faking them, they have an expert there. And being an expert myself, I know that that expert knowledge is very hard to come by. So I say, well, is that expert knowledge the raw? Isn't it there? Because if the expert knowledge isn't there, this has got to be real." Gentleman explained that if you throw a model into a scene, it will be frozen by the camera in a certain position, and the scale of the lighting on the model's surface, the angles and intensity of reflection, will indicate its small size and its relatively close proximity to the camera. Besides, he could see no way for a one-armed man to throw 3 or 4 models into the air at once and photograph them. "Some of them are behind the twigs on a tree," he noted. "You've got to be some special effects man to do that, I can tell you. And the objects that were behind the tree appeared to be at the right distance for ships that were a long way away. That's called aerial perspective. When you look at mountains, you see different colors that deepen in blue as you go farther away, and all of these photographs had that aerial perspective indicating distance. If you threw a lot of little silver things in the air at once, they'd all be lit within the space that you could throw them, which might be, what, 20 feet. But these certainly had the aerial perspective in the change of hue and tone on them. If the photographs were a cheat, they were superbly cheated, but I don't think they were." After studying the films, Gentleman concluded that considering the expertise necessary, the logistics, and the expense, a one-armed man with no assistance could not possibly have produced the footage. "That's the bottom line of everything," he said. "This Mia really had to have a fleet of clever assistants, at least 15 people, who would know what the interface reflections of a shiny object were at certain times of the day, how to support these objects so that wires are not seen, how to rig it, how to watch it and stand by with their little air guns to spray the strings when they begin showing up. What we would do is go out and shoot the scene, and then bring it back to the studio, and then shoot the object onto that film by duplication processes, which is a very sophisticated procedure. It's difficult to do on 35mm, even worse with the 8mm film he was using. And the equipment was totally out of his means. If somebody wanted me to cheat something along those lines, $30,000 would probably do it, but this is in a studio where the equipment exists. The equipment would cost another $50,000. I think the one telling part of all this is that a single man with one arm, if he indeed was on his own, could not have done it. I think it would be well nigh miraculous for a person with even two arms to do that sort of work by himself up on a mountaintop. Even if you get a balloon and you hang your object on a fine piece of thread underneath, it's going to blow in any direction it wants to go. And with a lot of those pictures where you've got three or four flying saucers, you would need balloons with strings of varying length, otherwise you could pick out where the string comes from. It would be very difficult to do those shots in that sort of condition outside. And the fall of the land makes it very risky to do anything like that. It's all that sort of complication that leads me to think that the objects he's photographed and filmed were there independently and he simply snapped the shutter. Irina Frenning, the woman who had discovered the photo journal on Mia in her friend's office late one night, was married to H. David Frenning, Jr., an astronautical engineer at McDonnell Douglas Corporation for 25 years who worked primarily in the highly classified field of military defense. A staff manager, he had helped to develop missiles for ballistic missile defense, and had done exploratory research to develop ideas and technology for advanced spacecraft design. A longtime member of the British Interplanetary Society and the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, Frenning had presented many papers on interstellar flight at technical conferences in Europe and the United States. The idea of actually transcending vast interstellar distances had intrigued Frenning for 15 years. Searching for a way to take humankind beyond the speed of light, he spent much of his spare time examining Einstein's theories of relativity and considering new ways to encompass those theories in a more general law, much as Einstein's laws of relativity had not violated, but encompassed Newton's laws of motion. As far back as 1966, Frenning, among others, had maintained that the barriers of space and time were not insurmountable, that someday humankind would indeed surpass the speed of light. In an article he wrote that year, he pointed out that only 20 years earlier hardly a scientist or engineer believed that man could break the sound barrier and survive. Many pilots had been killed trying. Yet, predicted Frenning, in the late 1980s hypersonic airliners would fly from New York to Madrid in less than an hour, or five times faster than the speed of sound. In his early research, Frenning immediately had concluded that rockets consuming terrestrial fuel would be too heavy and costly to achieve the speed of light. He also had considered and discarded the feasibility of interstellar ramjets that would scoop up hydrogen atoms and convert them to fuel as the craft traveled through cosmic space. The scoop would have to measure 60 miles in diameter. But Frenning continued to search. When Irina returned home that Monday, David was still out of town. Looking for the photo journal she had seen at her friend's office, she called around to several bookstores before locating a copy. When her husband returned home, she presented it to him before saying hello. "I guess I was never so impressed by a book," said David. "If what this Mia is saying is just a hoax, he's being cued by some very knowledgeable scientists." In 1986, President Reagan announced plans to develop the technology for a hypersonic airliner called the Orient Express. Later he said he felt numb. "But it was exciting," he added. "Kind of like a tingling and a numbing at the same time. It was a revelation. All of a sudden many things made sense. It had never occurred to me that tachyons might exist completely outside the dimension of time." Frenning had designed a theoretical quantum ramjet that could power starships to nearly light speed in a matter of hours by ubiquitous energy pulses that some scientists believe exist in the fabric of space. He also had theorized on the other side of the light barrier and had developed a conceptual model of what a craft might look like traveling faster than the speed of light. "But I didn't have anything to tie these two concepts together," he said. "What hung me up was the seeming impossibility of being able to cover these tremendous interstellar distances within a matter of minutes, rather than centuries here on Earth. Then I read the Mia book, and suddenly it all seemed plausible." Within 2 weeks, Frenning conceived a possible way to reach the speed of light and then make the transition to faster than light travel. Most people think that faster than light speeds occur on our normal space-time realm of existence, he explained. But when Mia mentioned that the trip took 7 hours and the longest part lasted only several seconds, it occurred to me that during that interval almost no time at all passes. And this gave me the further idea that you could actually arc above our space-time plane of existence and travel trillions of miles through space with only several seconds passing. I had never thought of that possibility. With the help of a bookstore owner, Frenning located Wendell Stevens in Tucson and called him for additional information on the reputed propulsion system. One thing impressed him about the more detailed contact notes sent by Stevens, the voice of Semjes addressed each of the major scientific requirements to accelerate to the speed of light, make the jump or hyperleap, and then decelerate. Though she doesn't say specifically how it's done, Frenning recalled, she gets technical enough to satisfy me as a scientist. And that's very convincing when someone does that. What further impressed Frenning was that almost a year before Irina discovered the photojournal, he had calculated the propulsion efficiency of his new quantum ramjet and determined that typical times for such a craft to reach light speed would be about 4 hours. According to Mia's figures, the Pleiadian ships required approximately 3.5 hours to accelerate to the speed of light, only seconds to traverse a distance of nearly 500 light-years, and then another 3.5 hours to decelerate and fly to Earth. The credibility of Mia's numbers amazed Frenning. To arrive at his figures, Frenning had utilized complex formulas involving acceleration rates. Then he discovered that not only did Mia claim it required 3.5 hours for the Pleiadian beam ships to reach the speed of light, but that at that point the ships would have traveled approximately 92 million miles. That figure, too, was within 20% of his own previous calculations. I think it would be very improbable for someone with Mia's educational background to hit on this combination of figures and have them be within a scientifically acceptable range, said Frenning. He would have to be coached by someone who's very knowledgeable in the sciences, who has knowledge of special relativity and of flight mechanics to know what kinds of times and distances make sense. If this is a hoax, it has to be with the assistance of someone like myself, who could account for the plausible things that take place. I've only discussed this Mia case with scientists who are fairly open-minded about interstellar flight, but I'll tell you, the majority of them think it's credible and agree with at least part, or sometimes all, of the things talked about by the Pleiadians. Before the golden-silver triangle had disappeared from the possession of Marcel Vogel, the IBM scientist had placed it under his $250,000 scanning electron microscope and turned on a videotape to record his findings. The tiny specimen held very pure silver, and very, very pure aluminum, plus potassium, calcium, chromium, copper, argon, bromium, chlorine, iron, sulfur, and silicon. One microscopic area revealed an enormous melange of almost all of the elements in the periodic table. And each was exceedingly pure. It's an unusual combination, Vogel said later, but I could not in any way, shape, or form say that this would make it extraterrestrial. What intrigued Vogel more than the number of elements and their purity was their discreteness. Each pure element was bonded to each of the others, yet somehow retained its own identity. It is uncanny when you look at the juxtaposition of the metals, he said as he looked through the microscope and talked out his findings for the videotape. One layer against another is very pure, but they do not interpenetrate. You have a combination of metals and non-metals together, very tightly bonded. I don't know of anybody even contemplating doing something like this. In one small area in the middle of the sample blown up 500 times, he found two parallel grooves joined by furrows, precise hairlines somehow micro-machined into the metal. But even more surprising to him was that the major element present in that small area was the rare earth metal thulium. It is totally unexpected, he said. Thulium was only purified during World War II as a byproduct of atomic energy work, and only in minute quantities. It is exceedingly expensive, far beyond platinum, and rare to come by. Someone would have to have an extensive metallurgical knowledge even to be aware of a composition of this type. The magnification of the half-inch piece went from 500 to 1,600, and Vogel saw things he had never seen before. A whole new world appears in the specimen. There are structures within structures, very, very unusual. At lower magnification one just sees a metallic surface. Now one sees a structure composed of various types of interlacing areas.